right, I think we're ready to get started. I'd like to welcome you, and most of you, I think I'm welcoming you back to the Christian Apologetics Methods course of the Theology Program, which is a ministry of Reclaiming the Mind Ministries. And I'm very happy that you are joining me for this hour and a half in which we will be talking about classical apologetics, really just introducing the subject of classical apologetics, getting familiar with it somewhat, and looking at certain individuals who might be regarded as typifying a classical apologetics approach. And next week we're going to delve into certain aspects of classical apologetics in greater depth, look at some specific issues. And at the end of this lecture, as we will try to do each week, there will be time for you to ask questions, make comments. Perhaps we'll get into some kind of a discussion, and I want to allow time for that. And please feel free to take advantage of that, and I'm happy to answer any question that I can, and happy to be corrected where I need to be corrected. And so that's basically the agenda here from now until an hour and a half from now, thereabouts. So with that little introduction, we will get started in our discussion of classical apologetics. Now, the term classical apologetics is the term of choice favored by those who actually advocate something along the lines of this family of approaches, perhaps we should call it, rather than a single approach, to Christian apologetics. They generally refer to themselves as classical apologists if they distinguish themselves at all as advocating a particular style or form or method or theory of apologetics. They generally refer to this as classical apologetics. Now, those who disagree with it, those who are critical of this approach, be they Christians of another approach to apologetics or non-Christians who are critical of this particular form of apologetics, often refer to it as rationalist apologetics, or perhaps simply rational apologetics. But calling it rational apologetics suggests that all of the other varieties of apologetics are not rational approaches, and that would not be correct. So the term rationalist would be a more precise term here. Rationalist apologetics is a term sometimes used with reference to a particular approach to Christian apologetics that those who advocate it prefer to call classical apologetics, because the term rationalist has a certain pejorative connotation. And we're going to find this coming up again and again with most, if not all, of the other approaches to apologetics, that there are terms that are used by critics, terms that are used by advocates, and as in most debates, being able to choose one's terminology and define the terms enables one to claim some kind of linguistic high ground. We see this in the abortion debate constantly. Who wants to be anything but pro-life? Who wants to be against choice? You know, the terms get defined, labeled, positions get labeled, and terms get defined in order to make one's position seem as strong as possible just by the way the words are used. An observation that has been made by one of the greatest of all classical apologists, C.S. Lewis, and we're going to talk a little bit about him. But those who would criticize this approach to apologetics would say that it is rationalistic. And what do they mean by that? What they mean by that, and indeed typically is something pejorative, which is the idea that this particular approach to apologetics gives too much emphasis on or too much credence to logic as a means toward the pursuit of the knowledge of the truth. That logic is given a primacy in classical apologetics, that is actually a problem, according to critics of this approach. And rationalism, to use the noun form, is a particular approach to epistemology, and I'm starting to throw out some 50-cent words here, but I will try to define them as we go along. Rationalism is a particular approach to epistemology, which is the theory of knowledge. Epistemology is the study and philosophy of what knowledge is and how we get it, how we can know anything to be true, and how knowledge is justified or warranted. And rationalism, and there are various kinds of rationalism, so I'm going to have to simplify here, but rationalism basically is an approach to epistemology that says we know what can be logically demonstrated. We know what is logically and specifically deductively demonstrable. So if I can show from a certain premise that something must be true, then I know something, because there is a certain connection between the premise or the premises and the conclusion, and that gives the conclusion a kind of confidence level that many people would say is required if one is going to claim to know something. And so rationalism gives reason, at the very least, a primacy or a leading role, a primary role in the acquisition or the justification of knowledge. How do you know something? The rationalist, first of all, will say, well, can you logically show that this is so? And classical apologists, classically, if I may put it that way, have given indeed some kind of emphasis or priority to logic, to rationality, if not rationalism, to the use of reason, and especially deductive reasoning, and we'll explain what that means, hopefully, very quickly, in order to show that Christianity is true. The classical apologist wants to use arguments, as much as possible at least, in which the conclusions are regarded as following necessarily from the premises. And that's what a deductive argument is. A deductive argument is one in which you start with a very limited number of pieces of information called premises. And I'm, like I said, using a lot of words here that need to be defined. But a premise is a statement that one uses as the basis for an argument that leads to a conclusion. And in a deductive argument, you want to have as few of these premises as possible, because you don't want to have to argue for all of the a lot of different premises. You want to have as few premises as possible, and you want those to be regarded as certain. If at all possible, you want them to be regarded as beyond controversy. And then from these limited number of premises, a deductive argument reaches a conclusion which is regarded as, and again I'll use this phrase, necessarily following from the premises. Now what does that mean? What that means is if the premises are true, the conclusion has to be true. Now, of course, perhaps the premises are false, but again, the rationalist wants to start with premises that are at least very difficult to deny and perhaps impossible to deny. Ideally, that's what they want. They want premises that are really impossible to deny, and then they want an argument form that guarantees that if the premises are true, the conclusion has to be true. So, and now, again, when we use the term classical apologist or classical apologetics, we're talking about a typology, a kind of approach to apologetics, for which there are a number of variations, and some people approach this type more in a more pristine way, perhaps one might describe it, or purest way than others. And that doesn't mean that those who don't approach it as in as pristine a fashion are poorer apologists, but they are less rationalistic or give less emphasis or priority to reason or logic than perhaps other approaches. So, rightly or wrongly, classical apologetics is accused by its critics of being rationalistic in its use of reason to try to come up with arguments that cannot be overturned on any grounds, and that therefore prove beyond any dispute, beyond any objection, that Christianity is true. Why do critics of classical apologetics dislike these arguments? Well, we'll be exploring that as we go along, especially next week, but some of them are suspicious that these arguments are trying to do too much, that they are too ambitious, that there are holes in the arguments, that the premises are not really beyond controversy, that in some way perhaps a rationalistic argument is taking the place of faith or displacing or supplanting faith or usurping the role of faith in knowledge. I mean, there are all kinds of objections that people raise to this project of constructing deductively certain arguments for the truth of Christianity or for the truth of the existence of God or some other part of the Christian message. So the standard typology, the standard type of a classical apologetics argument is one that seeks to reason from a limited number of premises, hopefully only one or two, all the way to the conclusion that Christianity is true, the Bible is inerrant, Jesus Christ is the risen Son of God, Savior of the world, in such a way that those conclusions are regarded as following either deductively and necessarily and therefore absolutely certain, or as close as we can get to rational certainty for those conclusions. Now, we're going to look at some different apologists who have been categorized as classical apologists, and as you'll see, that the standard type that I've described here is perhaps a specific line that one can draw and say that would really be a definite example of a classical apologist arguing that way. But there are apologists who are broadly categorized as classical who do not approach it in quite this way, or whose arguments do not generally come across as rational, deductive types of arguments. What then is the essence of the classical approach? I'm going to submit, for the sake of simplicity, a fairly easy to understand way of distinguishing the classical approach from all other approaches. And I think this holds up pretty well, although people could argue about this or that aspect of it. The classical approach to apologetics can be described as a two-step method. A two-step argument for the truth of Christianity. The classical approach tries to show that Christianity is true in two stages of reasoning. Stage one, theism, arguing that God exists. The first step in the classical argument, the classical case for God, for Christianity, is to show that God exists, that there is a creator God who is distinct from the world, who brought the world into being, on whom the world depends for its continued existence and its continued nature, its continued thriving, on whom therefore we also can continue to depend daily and moment by moment for our existence and our life, and so that there is a God. That's basically the step one of the two-step argument for Christianity in classical apologetics. Step two is to argue specifically for Christianity as a a species of theism, as a particular type of theism. In other words, the classical apologist approaches this this way. First, he is going to argue for the truth of the theistic worldview, the worldview that says there is a creator God, and that worldview would be a generic one that could be said, to some extent at least, to be shared by traditional believers in Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. And despite their theological differences, Jews, Muslims, and Christians historically have all been theists. They have all held to the existence of this personal, infinite creator God. Of course, there are people within all three of those religions who do not, but especially in Judaism and Christianity. But nevertheless, generally speaking, historically speaking, Jews, Muslims, and Christians have all been theists. So the classical apologist seeks to demonstrate, first of all, that theism is true, so that if the classical apologist is successful in stage one, he or she has demonstrated that we are limited to three major religious choices, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. Then the classical apologist seeks to eliminate Judaism and Islam and to vindicate Christianity as the true religious expression of theism. And so that's basically classical apologetics in a nutshell. First, arguing that God exists, and then arguing that this God has revealed himself in Jesus Christ, and that that revelation, of course, has been preserved for us in written form in the New Testament, and therefore in the Bible as a whole. And anybody who holds to that is, in some loose sense at least, a Christian. They have embraced Christianity, at least in a general sense, as true. And so the Christian apologist has made his case by arguing, first, that there is a God, and second, that this God is supremely revealed, known, and related to through Jesus Christ, his Son. Now, if somebody argues for Christianity along these lines, they are basically following the classical approach. They may argue in these two stages in various ways, and they may not look at all alike in terms of the style in which they develop their case for Christianity. But if they follow this two-step approach, you could classify them, at least broadly speaking, as a classical apologist. All right, so hopefully that's pretty clear as to what a classical apologist is and how they approach. Now, of course, we're going to be looking at other apologists and other approaches in subsequent classes who would not be in this category, and as we do so, we will see that there are alternative approaches to defending Christianity that do not follow this two-step approach. It may be self-evident to you that there are other approaches, and you may even feel that there are superior approaches. On the other hand, you may be puzzled that anybody would do it any other way than this. You may say, well, of course, that's the way that you would go about doing it. if that's your reaction, I guess you're a classical apologist. So we will be exploring alternative approaches to defending Christianity as we go along. This is not the only approach. And as we do so, you'll have a clearer understanding of what's distinctive about this classical approach, and perhaps begin to form some opinions as to whether this is the best approach or not. I would recommend, if as much as you can, and I realize some of you have a head start on this and have already thought about this, and of course that's great. But as much as you can, you might want to suspend judgment, if you can do that, as to which approach you think is best, or whether you think this approach is the best approach, perhaps only by default because this is the one that you've always followed, until you've heard the other three major approaches that we'll be talking about. And again, there are variations on those. And you'll be able to come to a more rich and a well-informed understanding of the approaches, and you may end up deciding at the end of the day that you're going to stick to the same approach that you started off with. That's great. That's fine. You may find, though, that you are enriched in applying that approach by having been exposed to these other approaches. So nobody here needs to be afraid that I'm going to be trying to talk them out of their particular approach to apologetics. I'm not going to be doing that. I'm not going to try to change your mind, say you shouldn't be that kind of an apologist. But I am going to be encouraging you to learn from all of the approaches and to find out what you can use from them and give them a serious consideration as possibly offering something that the approach that you're using lacks. And see where you are when we come to the end of the course. And again, if you're just joining us this week, all of this information, more or less, can be found in a book that I co-authored called Faith Has Its Reasons. And that book is in print in its second edition. If you have the first edition, may I encourage you to consider acquiring a copy of the second edition one way or another, because I've made some very significant revisions in the second edition. The second edition is not a cosmetic throw on a new preface and call it a second edition type of a book. I went through every page and made page changes on almost every page and updated a lot of information. And I think if you've looked at the first edition, you'll find the second edition to be helpful as well. By the way, this question that's being asked right now, I'd encourage you to remember this question toward the end, and I probably can address it better at the end during the question and answer time, since it is a little off topic. All right, so let me begin having introduced the concept of classical apologetics. Let's start looking at some specific examples of people that belong, or at least arguably belong, in this category of classical apologetics. And I cannot spend time talking about each individual even mentioned in the book and why they belong in this category and so forth. I'm going to be selective and just talk about a couple of individuals that I think everybody has probably heard of, and if you haven't, you should have if you're interested in Christian apologetics. And the first of these, and I've already mentioned him, is C.S. Lewis. Now, C.S. Lewis's story is very interesting, and it has some relevance to understanding why he belongs in this category of a Christian apologist, a classical Christian apologist. Lewis, as you probably know, was a British professor of medieval literature who was, for some years, an atheist and became convinced, against his desire, as he testified, that Christianity was true and that his atheism was not an intellectually credible position. And so he abandoned his atheism and embraced Christianity. Now, Lewis's own story is of his conversion is a little bit complicated. So what I'm going to say is admittedly a simplification. And if you want to call it an oversimplification, you're justified in doing that. But essentially, what happened was that Lewis became convinced that there was some kind of a creator God, but it took a little bit more doing before he was prepared to accept the whole ball of wax, as it were, and accept Christianity and submit himself to Jesus Christ as Lord and Savior. And that experience, which again I'm admitting is something of an oversimplification, but I still think is a fairly rough and ready description of what happened with Lewis, is perhaps paradigmatic of the classical approach. You first come to terms with the idea that there is a creator, that there is a God that made the world. You don't really necessarily know very much about him, You don't know what he wants. You don't know who he is. You just know there is one. And then, having determined that there is a God, you find out that God has revealed himself in the Bible and preeminently in Jesus Christ, personally and preeminently in Jesus Christ, and that Jesus Christ is the way to have a relationship with this Creator God. Well, that's the classical argument in a nutshell. First, God, theism; second, Christ and the Bible. That's more or less the way it went down with Lewis, with some complications and complexities, as would be expected in any human life, not a straight line experience, but still that's a fairly useful simplification of Lewis's conversion process. Lewis himself, having been convinced by argument, by reasoning, that Christianity was true, became 20th century Christianity's best known and most beloved apologist himself. He wrote numerous books defending Christianity. Mere Christianity is probably the best known. In Mere Christianity, Lewis attempted to present a case for Christianity that was not specific to any particular denomination, but rather simply, here's what Christians believe, here's what you have to believe in order to be a Christian, here's why we believe these things, this basic bottom line, minimal Christian confession. And by the way, that's fairly typical for classical apologists. Classical apologists are generally focused on a kind of generic Christian faith. They want to demonstrate that God exists and that Jesus Christ is the eternal Son of God, Lord and Savior, risen from the dead. Anything beyond that they would regard as theology and not apologetics. And so you find typically classical apologetics is developed and championed by people who are not particularly well known for being advocates for a very specific theological system. And if I could get specific here, and this anticipates where we'll be going in a few weeks, typically classical apologists are not champions for Reformed or Calvinistic theology. Calvinist theologians, Calvinist apologists tend, more often than not, and there are exceptions, but they tend more often than not to be interested in defending Calvinism and defending a Reformed Calvinistic approach to theology, to everything. And so they see defending Calvinism as part and parcel of apologetics. Classical apologists, they may be Calvinists, and some of them are, but they tend not to view apologetics that way. They tend to distinguish between apologetics, which seeks to get people in the door of Christianity, and theology, which seeks to help people who are Christians decide, as C.S. Lewis put it, which room of the house of Christianity is the best room to live in. These are very different approaches to apologetics, you can see right there. But anyway, C.S. Lewis, Mere Christianity, classic example of classical apologetics, in which Lewis first argues that there is a God, and then argues that this God has revealed himself in Jesus Christ and shown us what he wants and what the program is, what life is all about, and how we are to get on board with God's design and God's plan for humankind. So that's very typical of classical apologetics. That's a very standard example of the way classical apologists reason. Now, that having been said, C.S. Lewis does not fit most people's mold of a classical apologist. It's kind of interesting, after the first edition of Faith Has Its Reasons, a couple of scholars, apologists, very sharp individuals, took issue with my classification of C.S. Lewis as a classical apologist. And they have a point, because he doesn't look anything like the other individuals, and one in particular that we're going to talk about next, that are put in that same room of or that same category of apologetics, of the classical, very rational type approach. Lewis's apologetic efforts were not limited at all to rational argument. He was happy writing allegories, science fiction, biography, children's stories, all kinds of forms of communication, all sorts of genres of communication, some of which did not in any way present rational arguments, deductive or other kinds of reasonable, rational types of arguments for Christianity. But these had an apologetic purpose. They were designed to foster a mindset in which Christianity would seem reasonable to people. And so Lewis bursts the simplistic, narrow categories or definitions of classical apologetics as a purely rational enterprise of seeking to construct a deductive argument that proves that God exists, and then go from there to try to establish that God has revealed himself in Christ. His approach is just so diverse. He uses so many different types of arguments and types of presentations that it is very difficult to classify him in a simple way. Now, I do agree, though, with those, including Norman Geisler and David K. Clark, who classify C.S. Lewis as a classical apologist. And again, Mere Christianity is a model of the classical approach. You first present arguments for God's existence that don't bring Jesus or the Bible into the picture at all. Lewis begins by offering a philosophical case for theism, and his showcase argument for God's existence is the moral argument. We have a moral compass, we have a moral center, we have a moral awareness. We know that there are certain things that are morally right and morally wrong. There is a moral law, Lewis argues. If there's a moral law, there has to be a moral law giver. And this is what we mean by God. And so Lewis constructs a philosophical reasoned argument, a general argument for God's existence that it does not require you to accept anything that he might believe about Jesus or the Bible. In fact, he doesn't have to bring them up at all. And then only after establishing that God exists does Lewis bring in Jesus and the Bible. Well, that's the classical approach. Now, toward the end of his career, Lewis found, by his own confession, that there were some limitations or some qualifications that he needed to make to this approach. He felt that many of the popular arguments for God's existence were not valid. That is, they were not logically tight arguments. There were holes in them. There were potential objections. Now, we need to be clear about this, because many people do not understand the terminology here. In logic, an argument is said to be invalid if it is not logically, deductively, strictly constructed properly so that the conclusion follows necessarily from the premises. an argument might be invalid deductively and still have some merit in some other way. Because not all arguments have to be deductive arguments, and we'll be talking about different kinds of arguments as we go along here. But Lewis said that although he had difficulty coming up with definitive arguments for God's existence, it turned out he didn't need them very much. Because he said most people he talked to were not atheists. They did not insist that there was no God. They were rather open to the idea of a God, but they had trouble with Christianity. So he would, as he got older, and toward the end of his career, Lewis would just go straight to Christ and the Bible, because that's where he felt people were ready to be met. But Lewis, in saying that, is of course revealing that, in his opinion, the reason why you don't need to start off with theistic arguments in most cases is that most people already believe in some kind of a God, and there aren't that many atheists out there, and you can basically, in most cases, get straight to it about Jesus. If you've got a culture which is increasingly atheistic, which is the case throughout the Western world now, especially in Western Europe, but increasingly here in the United States as well, then the necessity of arguing for God's existence becomes more acute. It becomes more important to do that. So C.S. Lewis is a classical apologist in a broad sense, belongs in this particular tradition of apologetics, but he is a very well-versed, a very literate kind of classical apologist who uses a variety of types of presentations. And as somebody pointed out, some of these more classical forms of apologetic argument get kind of smuggled in a creative way into the stories, into the children's novels, and into the science fiction novels, and into the allegory. So they're there. They're sort of woven into the story, into the narrative, and little comments made by various characters in the stories. So they're in those stories as well. But the point is that he's not limited to a kind of straight philosophical discourse approach to trying to prove Christianity by, you know, setting out some kind of logical, rational argument. Now, some people, though, that's just what they want. They want a straightforward, down-the-line, boom, 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 logically tight argument for Christianity that is as close to a purely deductive type of argument as you could hope for, as you can get. And the preeminent example of a classical apologist in this narrow sense of one who seeks to adhere to a kind of rational ideal in defending Christianity would be Norman Geisler. And let me type his name here, because if you've never seen it before, it's perhaps hard to spell. Norman Geisler, he's written or edited, over 60 books. I don't know how many it is now, because there's always new ones coming out, so it's probably a lot more than 60 at this point. Geisler is a Christian philosopher by training, and he has taught apologetics and Christian theology at various places throughout the years. He helped to found a Southern Evangelical Seminary in North Carolina back in 1992. He has been a leading Christian apologist, evangelical Christian apologist, in the last 30 years or so, by anybody's reckoning. He is a major Christian apologist. If you had to come up with a list of 10, the 10 most influential evangelical apologists of the last 30 years, Maybe we should say 40 years, especially the last 30 years, 35 years, he would have to be on the list. And many people would argue he'd have to be on a list of five. Now, Norman Geisler explicitly and openly, avowedly defends a two-step approach to apologetics. He calls himself a classical apologist. He argues that classical apologetics is the proper way of defending Christianity. You must first establish that God exists, and having established that God exists, you then go on to establish that this God has miraculously revealed himself in the events and in the writings of the Bible, and preeminently in his son Jesus Christ. So Dr. Geisler is, without question, a classical apologist. He is probably fairly regarded as the paradigm example of a Christian apologist from the classical school of thought. Now, I've described his view as a two-step argument. But, of course, each of these steps has sub-points under it, because to argue that God exists is going to require several points of the argument. And over the years, Dr. Geisler has developed his rational argument for Christianity, and in recent years has presented this, elaborated this two-step method in what he calls 12 points that show Christianity is true. And if you follow this along, you will see that the intent, the purpose, the method of this particular 12-step argument, this this 12-point argument is to show that Christianity is rationally the position you should go with, that this is as close to a purely rational argument for Christianity as you could get. Now, it isn't purely deductive, but it's close, and that is the ideal against which Dr. Geisler works in this particular 12-point argument. Now, I'm going to go through this very quickly. If you have Faith Has Its Reasons, it is on the in the second edition. It's not in the first edition, because Geisler developed this, was developing it around the same time, I guess, as the first edition came out. But it's in the second edition on pages 57 and 58. But I'm going to go through this quickly, because it is in the book, but I am going to go through it because I think it will really help you understand classical apologetics. And of course, again, Norman Geisler is one of the most influential evangelical apologists of our day, and has been for quite a long time. So, very quickly, point number one, truth about reality is knowable. Now, Geisler's intent here is to start with premises, or premises, if you will, that are beyond reasonable argument. In other words, these premises are beyond debate as far as he's concerned. And by the way, I would agree with him about that. But the point is that his method is to try to begin with premises that the non-Christian would have a really tough time disputing. And that, in fact, the Christian can argue that the non-Christian is being irrational or unreasonable to dispute these opening premises. All right, so he begins, truth about reality is knowable. And according to Geisler and other classical apologists, if you try to deny this first premise, you end up having to assume it in order to disprove it. You claim to know that it is, that truth about reality is not knowable. And so you end up sawing off the branch that you're sitting on, like one of those characters in the Looney Tunes cartoons. And so, according to the classical approach, we start with the premise here that nobody can reasonably or rationally deny, which is that truth about reality is knowable. Point number two for Geisler, the opposite of true is false. That's just true by definition, so there's really not too much to argue about there. Number three, it is true that the theistic God exists. Now, this is point three, but this is a big one, and of course, at this point, Geisler, as all classical apologists will do, will offer some arguments to show that it is rationally can be rationally demonstrated that the theistic God exists. And Geisler believes that one can construct a rationally compelling, deductively compelling argument, deductively certain argument, that God exists. And we will be getting into how he does that actually probably next week, because it's a big subject. But he's going to argue that the theistic God exists. His argument of choice for this is called the cosmological argument, which is the argument that reasons from the nature of the world to the conclusion that there must be something that transcends the world that brought it into existence and that sustains its existence, and that's what we call God, the God of theism. Well, we'll elaborate on that argument next time, because that's obviously key to the whole project of classical apologetics. Point number four, if God exists, then miracles are possible. And Geisler insists that we've got to do apologetics in this order. You cannot argue for the resurrection of Jesus as an historical fact until you've established that miracles are possible. But, he points out, you can't establish that miracles are possible until you first establish that God exists. Therefore, according to Geisler, in order to argue for the truth of Christianity, which of course you have to argue for the truth of the miracle of the resurrection, in order to argue for the truth of Christianity, you have to do it in this order. You have to start with the existence of God, show that God exists, then you can move forward to show that miracles are possible, and then and only then, can you move forward to show that a miracle actually occurred in history, which is the miracle of the resurrection of Jesus? But we're a long way from that in his argument. All we've gotten so far is that theism is true. Number four, if God exists, then miracles are possible. Now, this is really just, in a sense, an elaboration of theism. If you stopped at point three, it is true that the theistic God exists. You could have a confusion here, because if you don't include miracles, what you have is not real theism, it's actually deism, the idea that there is a creator God, but he is wholly transcendent and not immanent in creation and cannot affect the course of creation once he makes it. That's not the God of theism, that's not the God that Geisler is talking about. And so what he does is he explicates one of the implications of theism, which is that if there is a God who created the universe out of nothing, then he certainly has the capacity to intervene in its history and to bring new events into the historical flow. And those events that he introduces in this interventionist manner are what we call miracles. The cosmological argument, again, I'm going to spend considerable time discussing that and elaborating on that next week as we do part two on classical apologetics. So I apologize that I'm going to duck that question, at least for now. We'll see if we have time perhaps to get into that a little bit in the Q&A time, which we're going to try to have in maybe 10 or 15 minutes, depending on how many questions there are. But point number four, then, in this 12-point outline that Geisler presents, is if God exists, then miracles are possible. Point number five, miracles can be used to confirm a message from God. That makes sense. If there are miracles, if they're possible, God could use miracles to confirm a message that he wanted to give to us. Then point number six, the New Testament is historically reliable. Now, at this point, Geisler acknowledges that his argument's not deductive. And Geisler's quite clear about this. He's not embarrassed by this. He would insist he's not a rationalist. He's not somebody who is arguing for rationalism as that logic is the only means of acquiring knowledge. Geisler rejects rationalism In fact, one of the high points, probably for many people, of his early book on Christian apologetics, which was called Christian Apologetics, is his rejection of rationalism, which surprises many people because they often think of Geisler as a rationalist, but he's not. He explicitly says logic only takes you so far. So at this point, having established rationally that God exists, Geisler turns to the historical evidence, which he acknowledges is not something that can be rationally proved in a deductively certain fashion. But, he argues, we can show that it is that the preponderance of evidence favors the conclusions that he's going to draw once we've established the possibility of these things by having shown that there is a God and that he might be able to do miracles. So point number 6, the New Testament is historically reliable. Point number 7, the New Testament says Jesus claimed to be God. Point number 8, Jesus' claim to be God was miraculously confirmed. And Geisler identifies 3 ways in which Jesus' claim to be God was miraculously confirmed: by his fulfillment of prophecies, by his sinless and miraculous life, his miracle-performing life, and, of course, by his resurrection preeminently. So Geisler's point number 8, Jesus' claim to be God, was miraculously confirmed in these ways. Point number 9, therefore, Jesus is God. If you claim to be God and then confirm, miraculously validate that claim, then the claim has to be regarded as true, and therefore it is true that Jesus is God. That's point number 9. Point number 10, in Geisler's 12-point outline, whatever Jesus, who is God, teaches is true. And you can see logically, if you've now the argument is deductive again, because if Jesus is God and God is omniscient and perfectly truthful, then of course everything that Jesus says is going to be true. Number 11, Jesus taught that the Bible is the Word of God. And then number 12, therefore it is true that the Bible is the Word of God. So as you can see, Geisler has constructed a logical argument, a 12-point argument, which has subpoints under it. As I mentioned, there are subpoints required to establish that God exists. There are subpoints required to establish that the New Testament is historically reliable. But in any case, this is the 12-point outline of the as much as he could make it, a rational argument, not a rationalistic argument in his view, but a rational argument for the truth of Christianity. Now, as you can see then, the 12 points really correspond to the 2 steps. The first 5 points out of the 12 really focus on establishing theism, that reality is knowable, whatever is not true is false, the theistic God exists. If he exists, then miracles are possible, and God, if he exists, then could use miracles to confirm his message to the world. Those are all really subpoints in the argument for step 1, that the theistic God exists. The other 7 points 6 through 12, are subpoints under the second step of the case for Christianity in classical apologetics, which is to show that God has supremely revealed himself in Jesus Christ and in the Bible. So that's a very helpful way of understanding these 12 points, is that is they all basically are an elaboration of the basic 2-step argument that Geisler has been championing for well over 30 years in his publications, actually 40 years in his writings. Now, I've mentioned a couple of I've mentioned Geisler's 12 points, and these are found in various books. I want to mention a couple of books that are very basic to understanding Geisler's approach. One of them I've already mentioned is Christian Apologetics, and in this book he sets out his apologetic method. To set out his apologetic method, he first sets out what it is not. It is not agnosticism. It is not rationalism. It is not fideism. And we're going to talk about fideism in a few weeks, which is the idea that knowledge is based on faith alone. It is not experientialism, etc. He goes through all these different approaches to knowledge, these epistemologies, which he says they all have something good in them, but they also all have problems and they're inadequate. And having gone through those various epistemological approaches, he proposes his own way of demonstrating that something is true that involves a kind of a two-edged sword of knowledge, or a two-edged sword of truth-seeking. And I want to just mention this briefly because it's critical to understanding Geisler's approach. He argues that we should recognize two tests for truth. And actually, one of these is a test for falsehood, a test that will show not that something is true, but that it cannot be true. And the other is a test to show that it must be true, that something must be true. The first test to show that something cannot be true is what he calls unaffirmability. And I'm going to have to write that one out. Unaffirmability. I hope I spelled that right. Unaffirmability is the test that says if something cannot be affirmed without contradicting yourself, then it cannot possibly be true. For example, it cannot, according to Geisler and all classical apologists, it cannot be true that all truth is relative. Because the statement or the proposition all truth is relative is making a non-relative statement. It is asserting that it is absolutely true, that there is no absolute truth, or that all truth is relative. And that is a contradiction. You can't say that. You can't affirm that. I mean, you could write it. You can say it. But you can't affirm it without contradicting it. And so this is what Geisler means by unaffirmability. It's a technical term that he uses to mean it cannot be consistently or coherently affirmed. So if something is unaffirmable, it cannot be true. And according to Geisler, you can learn a lot by simply applying this criterion, because there are a lot of worldviews that are rationally unaffirmable, that where it is actually nonsense to try to affirm, for example, any worldview that is relativistic is unaffirmable by definition, because relativism is self referentially incoherent, to use another fancy expression. In other words, in referring to itself, it refutes itself, it denies itself. It's like the liar's paradox. Everything I tell you is a lie. The statement, everything I tell you is a lie, is either true or false. And either way, it's not good for the statement. by the way, those of you who are Trekkies may remember that Spock used this to confuse a bunch of androids in a particular episode of Star Trek. Well, why? Because it blows the mind to try to make sense of a statement like this. It cannot be true. And it's not just that it factually cannot be true. It just can't be. No matter what world you live in, it cannot be true that everything I tell you is a lie. Somebody remembered. See, I wasn't making that up. So unaffirmability, as demonstrator illustrated in the liar's paradox, is a key component of Geisler's apologetic method, because he uses it as a sword to cut away all of the false worldviews that cannot possibly be true, and then what is left standing can be true, and then has to be examined to see if it holds up as well. The other test that he uses is a positive test for the truth of a worldview, and that's what he calls undeniability. And I'm going to write that one out as well. Undeniability occurs when a statement is definitionally true or existentially self-confirming. Now, that's a mouthful. What do I mean by that? Well, see, there's two kinds of undeniable statements. The first is statements that are definitionally true. A triangle has three sides. There's nothing to argue about there, because once you understand the words in the sentence, you know it's true. And one of the nice things about these kinds of statements is you don't need to go out in the world and examine anything to find out if it's true. You don't have to go look it up in an encyclopedia. You don't have to go do a survey. Go out and examine 100 triangles and see how many of them have three sides. hey, how about that? 97 out of 100 triangles have three sides. No, you don't have that situation because all triangles, by definition, have three sides. It is therefore, in Geisler's term, undeniable that a triangle has three sides. Now, there are other statements that are arguably undeniable that are more philosophically and religiously interesting, but that's just an easy example that Geisler uses to illustrate the point. The other kind of undeniable statement is one that is existentially self-confirming, such as, I exist. Now, the statement, I exist, is not true by definition. It could be that I didn't exist. I mean, it could have been possible that there was no Rob Bowman in the world. It'd be a tragic loss, but nevertheless, I don't have to exist, but it turns out that I do. And so when I say I exist, it's not true by definition, but it is existentially self-confirming. It's undeniable, therefore. I mean, it would be ridiculous for me to say I do not exist. And Geisler's point there is you can say I don't exist, but it doesn't mean anything because the very statement that you're trying to assert there assumes there is an I to make the statement. So the statement I do not exist is unaffirmable. The statement I do exist, or simply I exist, is undeniable. Now, Dr. Geisler believes that it is possible to construct a philosophical deductive argument for God's existence, beginning with premises that are undeniable. That you don't have to use any premises that are empirically derived, that you have to go out into the world and take soil samples or do spectral analyses of stars or anything of that nature. You don't have to do any of those things. Just use your noodle, use your intellect, and think about these things, and you will know, once you follow the chain of argument, that there is a God. And therefore that theism is true. And like I said, and I apologize for this, but after all, I do have to find some way of encouraging you to come back next week, we will be elaborating on this argument, which is known as the cosmological argument. And I'll go ahead and write that one out. We'll be elaborating on that next week. And trust me, we don't want to try to do that now because we want to spend a good amount of time on that and we want to have a discussion about it because it's key to the approach of almost everybody who's in the classical apologetics tradition. Almost everybody who is a classical apologist likes the cosmological argument and they typically use it. In fact, evangelical apologists of a classical stripe tend to rely on the cosmological argument very heavily. So we want to spend a considerable amount of time on that. And I can explain a little bit about that in the Q&A if we have time and there aren't other questions crowding our attention. But that's just an introduction to classical apologetics. Again, just to summarize, there is the essence of the classical approach is this two-step model in which you first argue that there is a God, a creator of the world, who's distinct from the world and brought it into being. And second, you argue that this God has revealed himself, made himself known, and made it possible for us to have a relationship with him supremely in Jesus Christ as revealed in the Bible. And William Lane Craig, who's just been mentioned, is an example of a classical apologist. He is somebody that certainly describes himself as a classical apologist and quite accurately describes himself that way. And one of the leading classical apologists of our day, beyond any question. So, that's a little introduction to classical apologetics. We've got plenty of time now for your comments, your questions, perhaps something that I brought up that you want to jump on, perhaps something that just it came to your mind as we were going along, even though it might be a little bit astray, that's all right. Want to just open it up now for your comments and questions, and if you want to use the mic, I will release the microphone to you. If you want to type your question, you can do that. I will read the question aloud and then answer it. So either way that you would like to do that, this is your time now, the next half hour, 25 minutes or whatever, for you to ask your questions or make your comments, And I'll just leave it at that now, open it up to the floor. Since we don't have a question being brought up immediately, I'm going to... okay, great. As a practical matter, is classical apologetics usually directed toward atheists, or are there other categories of outsiders where the approach is useful? Well, I would say this. The classical approach has its most obvious application to those who are not theists. That would be anybody who's not Jewish, Muslim, or Christian, in the broadest sense of those terms. So if somebody is a pantheist, for example, believing that the world is divine in some sense, that God and the world are in some kind of symbiotic relationship or even identical, pantheist or panentheist, that is a different worldview, and the classical approach is relevant there. Hindus, Buddhists, people of other religions hold to different worldviews that are not atheistic, necessarily. There are atheist forms of Buddhism. Zen Buddhism really is, ultimately, I think, an atheistic belief system. But there are, of course, the line between pantheism and atheism is pretty thin in some places, pretty murky in some places. But in any case, anyone who's not a theist and not a believer in the creator God of monotheism, there would be an obvious application of classical apologetics. Now, the classical apologists would say, if you've got somebody who's a theist, you just go straight to step two. You don't have to do step one because they're already there. You can go straight on to step two. So you don't have to hit people over the head with an apologetic argument for God's existence if they already believe in God. So there's, you know, it's not a wooden application of the method where you have to go through step one before you can do step two. If the person already believes in God, you can go straight to step two. I'm going to let me address this question about Calvin's Institutes and Augustine City of God, and then I'll yield the microphone to DK Man. Calvin's Institutes definitely have a preference here, and that would be the Ford Lewis Battles edition in the Library of Christian Classics. Now, that's not the one that's available free online. There are earlier translations, versions of Calvin's Institutes in English that are available free online. Those are okay, but the one that I would very highly recommend, and the only way I know to get this is to obtain it by buying the book, or actually it's a two-book set, the Ford Lewis Battles edition of Calvin's Institutes in the Library of Christian Classics. Augustine City of God, I'm not as familiar with the different editions of that in English to be able to give you a specific recommendation off the top of my head. There are a number of very good editions of it, translations of it, but I really couldn't give you a specific recommendation on that off the top of my head. I'm going to yield the microphone here and take our next question.
Yeah, you mentioned before classical apologists utilize rationalism as their epistemology, and then after you said that, somewhere you said that they only use rationalism to a certain extent. So I'm just wondering, for who, I think it was Geisler you said, who said that he only uses rationalism so far, and then not everything is provable via logic. So I'm wondering, according to the Geisler and in general classical apologists, I'm wondering, what is the step further that you take? What is it? If it's not rationalism, does it go into faith, or what does it go into after step one? Thanks.
Sure, no problem. That's a good question, and probably should elaborate on this a little bit more. Well, again, we'll use Norman Geisler as an example because he is very influential in the way he's presented this particular method, and it is very commonly followed. And Bill Craig does the same thing. Basically, what you do, first of all, is you present a rational argument. Now, this isn't rationalism, according to Geisler, because rationalism says that reason or logic is the only source or path to knowledge, and Geisler would say that's not true. But it's a good first step. And so Geisler would argue that first we establish using reason, and reason alone, if possible, and he thinks it is possible, with the inclusion of existentially undeniable propositions like I exist or something exists, that Geisler argues that we start by showing that God exists. Then, step two is an empirical or evidential argument. And that is, one argues inductively rather than deductively. One argues based on empirical information, empirical fact, factual observation, data, as much information as you can get, and amasses together a body of information that will be arranged in an evidential argument to show that Christianity is true. And the conclusion does not follow necessarily or with logical certainty, but rather is an argument that is shown to be most probable, to be most probably correct based on the information that we have. Now, as we'll see in a couple weeks, there is an obvious parallel or overlap between classical apologetics and what is called evidential apologetics or evidentialism, because evidentialists also present arguments that are empirically grounded, arguments from factual information, factual observations about the world, about history, about nature, but especially about history. And these evidential arguments that are empirically grounded result in conclusions that follow as probably correct, most probably correct, based on the information that we have. The difference is that evidentialists prefer these types of arguments all down the line. Classical apologists wish to use these arguments only after establishing theism as the rationally grounded position, at least as Geisler classically establishes this particular model. You start by using philosophical arguments as much as possible that show that that theism must be true, rationally, logically, deductively must be true. Now, again, there are variations on this. People who are prepared to use deductive and inductive arguments at this stage, but the point is that they do use deductive arguments, and they tend to be philosophical type arguments. Then they want to turn to these evidential arguments, these historical arguments or scientific arguments, but especially historical arguments for the truth of Christianity that are inductive in form rather than deductive. And the difference there, again, is the evidentialist uses those types of arguments all the way along, and typically is not as favorably disposed, or may even be, very much opposed to deductive types of philosophical arguments for God's existence. So that's basically what the classical apologist is doing. Now, what that means is that the types of arguments that the classical apologist uses, let's say, to establish the resurrection of Jesus as an historical fact, are going to be the exact same arguments used by the evidentialist. The difference is that the classical apologist is going to claim that he has a superior method in that he's able to establish the plausibility of a miracle like the resurrection by having first established that God exists, whereas the evidentialist, from the classical apologetics point of view, is handicapped by not having first shown that it is plausible that a miracle might have occurred. So there is a dispute, and it's not a very rancorous one, by the way. It's become less and less of a hot argument, but there is something of a dispute between classical apologists and evidential apologists as to whether it is necessary first to establish that God exists on the basis of some kind of rational argument before proceeding to the evidential case for Christianity. And that's where the difference really lies. So, as you can see, in trying to explain classical apologetics, it's helpful to refer to other approaches, in particular evidentialism, and we will run into that again and again, which is why it is helpful to be familiar with all of the approaches, because then you'll have a context in which you'll understand why some people favor one approach rather than another. Let me yield the microphone again here.
Okay, thank you very much. With evidentialists that you were just mentioning there, being an evidentialist, wouldn't they realize that they are arguing basically the premises of empiricism or evidentialism would be to assume a material worldview and then come to the conclusion of a God existing rather than so then if that was the case, then why would they even begin to argue with the resurrection of Jesus without first of all making some presuppositional proposition like such as God existing? I mean, what I'm asking is don't they kind of realize that if they
All right, DK man, I got your question. Let me address that question. I'm actually going to have to beg off that, because the answer is that the evidential apologists recognize and are aware of this particular objection to their approach, but they believe that their approach is justified and that they have a reason why they're doing it the way that they're doing it. And to try to elaborate on that would really take us into what we're supposed to be doing 2 weeks from now. And so in 10 minutes, which is what we have left, I'm not going to attempt that. But suffice it to say that they are aware of the objection that you're raising, and they view their refusal to limit themselves to this two-step approach as a positive thing. They think that they have a stronger approach to defending Christianity than the classical view. And then, again, if all you've heard is the classical view, that may seem surprising. The classical apologist seems to make a very strong case, not only for Christianity, but for doing it in this way. And I'm not saying that they're wrong, but I'm saying that it turns out the evidentialist is aware of this, has thought through this, and has a response. And 2 weeks from now, we're going to look at that. And my approach, and I hope that you'll be patient with this, but my approach is going to be each week I am going to basically put myself in the shoes of an apologist from that point of view. I'm going to explain how they view apologetics. I'm going to present it as if at least I'm sympathetic to their view. I'm going to try to give as much of a positive, forceful explanation of their view as I can. Hopefully, 4 or 5 weeks from now, you'll start to be very confused as to what my view is, because you won't be sure what kind of an apologist I actually am, unless, of course, you've already read my books, and then you'll probably have an opinion on that. But my goal is to represent the different viewpoints in as fair-minded and strong and positive and salutary way as I can. And so when we get to evidential apologetics, I will be doing that. You will see you'll see it in a different light if you haven't had that experience. You'll understand why they approach it the way that they do. And That's really all I can say at this point. Again, I'm trying to be there's a certain pedagogical purpose here. I want to make sure that you get the full strength of each position, and so a quick answer to that might be a little bit misleading. So we will get to that in a couple of weeks. Let's see. We had a question I don't know if you pronounce that Scouter or Scooter. Can the classical approach gain traction with postmodernists and relativists? Ron. Okay, thank you, Ron. I'm not familiar with all the handles. Well, indeed, the classical approach sees itself, those who advocate this approach see their approach as very strong in dealing with postmodernism and relativism, precisely because they believe they have a knockout punch to relativism, which is the argument that relativism is unaffirmable, that it is self-referentially incoherent, that is, that it is really self-refuting. And I illustrated this earlier with the statement, you know, everything I tell you is a lie. Well, everything I tell you is relative, you know, or all truth is relative. These are statements that are unaffirmable. In affirming them, you are implicitly assuming that they're not true. And so the classical apologetics approach is viewed by its advocates as very strong and potent, because it's using logic to do something that really nothing else can do quite so effectively, and that is to show that there's no possibility of the relativist epistemology being true, that there's no possibility of a postmodernist way of looking at things being true. And so that is how they would view it. Now, of course, apologists of other approaches believe that their approach is also very strong. So when we talk about the other approaches, we'll see how they handle relativism. But the classical approach certainly claims to have a very potent response to postmodernism or relativism. If you're interested in listening to a classical apologist debate, there are several debates involving William Lane Craig as a Christian apologist. Ron is mentioning him as well. Some of these are available free online. You can listen to Bill Craig debating atheists and other non-Christians, and whether he's debating them on the existence of God or the resurrection of Jesus. His approach is a typical example of a classical apologetics method of defending Christianity. Now, as I've said, there are variations, and let me also make one more qualification here, and we'll probably close with this, and that is, as you might expect, there are apologists who generally favor one approach, but they might kind of borrow a little bit from another approach or two. So they might be classical apologists, but they might take a page or two out of the evidentialist notebook. Now, as I've said, all classical apologists agree with evidentialists in the type of arguments that are to be used in defending the resurrection of Jesus. They are historical evidential arguments. The difference is the classical apologist believes that some spade work needs to be done in the mind in terms of intellectually defending theism before one goes about trying to defend the resurrection of Jesus as an historical fact. But they're going to be using some of the same pages in the playbook, as it were, because they agree on that particular phase of the case for Christianity. But that having been said, there are apologists who, while one would classify them as classical apologists, in some ways often do seem to reason overall the way an evidential apologist would, and I would say Bill Craig is one of those. I would say that the differences between William Lane Craig's approach and that of many evidential apologists is not very great. Yes, there is a difference. Yes, Craig is a classical apologist, not an evidentialist per se, but it's not as if there are two completely separate viewpoints here with a gulf in between, and you can never get from one to the other, like getting from Hades to the bosom of Abraham. You know, it's not like that. There are shades of views that are between the two stereotypical positions of the classical approach and the evidentialist approach. And those are just two of the approaches. There are others as well. Now, Gary Habermas would be an example of an evidentialist. There is no question that Gary Habermas is an evidential apologist and not a classical apologist. And yet, you know, Geisler and Craig and Habermas, can use many of the same arguments, and they certainly can get along quite well and appreciate each other's work and do not see themselves as in an adversarial relationship in terms of apologetic method. And yet they do have Geisler and Bill Craig would be classical apologists, and Gary Habermas would not. He, in the end of the day, you'd have to classify him as an evidentialist. And again, you have to look pretty closely to even see a significant difference, because Bill Craig and Gary Habermas sound like they are using the same method when they talk about the resurrection, which is why it's easy to confuse us. J.P. Moreland, a very good example of a classical apologist. No question he is a classical apologist. Moreland doesn't profess to give much of a hoot as to what method you use, but in fact he is a classical apologist. And Alistair McGrath is a classical apologist. Now, again, the classical apologetics camp is a pretty broad camp, and there are differences. Any camp that can include C.S. Lewis and Norman Geisler is a pretty big camp, as one of my critics has pointed out, and they're right. It's a big camp. But I still think it's a useful categorization, because the approach that they typify is quite distinct in some very important ways from evidentialism, from the various kinds of reformed apologetics approaches we'll be talking about, and from fideism, and from approaches that attempt to deliberately attempt to combine some of these approaches, which we'll be talking about as well. Well, we have run out of time. And there's lots to talk about here in the coming weeks. We're going to elaborate next week on classical apologetics. We're going to talk about the cosmological argument. I would say that if the cosmological argument turns out not to be a good argument, classical apologetics is in some serious trouble, at least as it is typically practiced, although there are other arguments one can use instead, as the moral argument I mentioned that C.S. Lewis uses, and there are other arguments as well. We'll talk about those and other matters pertaining to classical apologetics next week, and then in subsequent weeks we'll be looking at the other approaches as well. Now, there is an outline, there is a syllabus available. If you did not get a copy of the syllabus, ask Carrie, and she will be happy to give that to you. And I believe that these sessions are going online after they are reviewed and checked to make sure that the audio is all right. They're going up on the website for, of the theology program. And I look forward to talking with you all next week. Again, if you can do it, I know some of you probably can't, but if you can, try to get a copy of Faith Has Its Reasons and read these chapters, because then you're going to be coming to these discussions with some understanding of the issues, and we can have an even more probably more vigorous discussion. But if you don't have the opportunity to do that, feel free to ask questions, feel free to participate, feel free to challenge what you're hearing. And again, I'll do my best to present each of these approaches in their strongest possible light, so that you can get the most out of what we're doing here. Thanks very much, and we'll see you here next week. Bye-bye.